Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Good morning, Dr. Zan. How are you today?
Very well. Feeling excited about learning about the world around me. Give us a call, 1-300-055-36 if you have a question. If you've got an answer or a comment, I know it's super hard to get through, but you can contact us in other ways with your answers or comments. The Triple J text line, 0439 757 555, and Dr. Carl's Twitter. He's got a screen in front of him. He can see those tweets direct at Dr. Carl. That's DocTorKarl. But we just take your questions on the phone because we love hearing your voices. And Zach is calling in from Wagga this morning. Hey, Zach.
Good morning, doctors. Happy Thursday.
Happy Thursday to you, Zach. What's your question?
Dr. Carl, I wanted to know about the long-term implications of magnets on the human body. I've got a small neodymium magnet implanted on the pad of my fourth finger on my left hand. I wanted to know what it might be doing to my blood.
Why?
Just a body modification thing.
Oh, so like a one by choice, not something that you needed to have, but one by choice?
No, one by choice.
Yeah, right.
And is it entirely buried beneath the skin?
It is entirely buried beneath the skin.
And there's no reactions from it?
Well, it reacts with, like, electrical fields, for example.
Wow.
So does that mean that you can attract things with your fingers and make people think that you're a magician?
Well, that's might be one of the reasons.
But what if you come up to another neodymium magnet? Doesn't it just rip itself out of your flesh?
No, it wobbles around. It definitely moves around under the flesh, but hasn't ripped out just yet.
Really? And there are no reactivity problems? Cause, for example, I realise that titanium has been chosen because it, and here's a fancy term, osseointegrates. It forms a coating of titanium dioxide, which then the bone can grow into. And finding something that's biocompatible is difficult, but this is okay so far.
It is coated in an implant-grade silicon.
Oh.
So it's totally encased.
Well, you learn something new every day. Okay, the effects of it on the human body. With regard to the effects on outside the brain, almost certainly zero. We've looked at non-ionizing electromagnetic radiation for a long time, never found anything. This is non-ionizing electromagnetic radiation, and non-ionizing in the sense that it does not rip electrons off atoms. On the brain, it can have effects. And so you can have what's called transcranial magnetic stimulation, where they get a magnet, a powerful magnet, and they blast a magnetic field into your brain. And for the next 30 minutes, after they've stopped, you can no longer organize that you catch this bus and then that bus and that bus. But on the other hand, somehow, while your logical capabilities have been pushed down, your artistic capabilities come to the fore. And even though you've never been able to draw a horse, which is very difficult, in your whole life, suddenly you can, but only for the next 20 minutes.
Wow.
And they've also been found, once again, only with the brain, to possibly be helpful with migraines and depression. Now, on the other hand, the one on your finger, all it's going to do is put a magnetic field on the blood cells, and I'm guessing that the effect would be so close to zero as to be indistinguishable from zero. Watch this space. We'll find out in 15 years. You're the guest. You're the guinea pig.
You're the future of magic and magicians and wizards as well. Now I know how they do it. Thanks so much for the call, Zach.
No worries. Thanks,
Doctor. See you later. Cherie is calling in from Adelaide. Hey, Cherie.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
I have a question about radio frequencies. Mm-hmm. My stereo sits on top of my fridge and it's been there for 3+ years and I've never had any troubles. And then a couple of months ago, I kept losing Triple J. I kept getting lots of static. And so if I'm in my house, the only way that I can hear the radio is if I put my palm basically on the top of the stereo and then I kind of reach my elbow down to make contact with my fridge, which is where my stereo is sitting. And it's the only way that I can listen to the radio in my house. And I'm wondering why that might be.
And it suddenly happened about 3.5 years ago?
No, the stereo has been on top of the fridge for about 3.5 years. It's only really been happening for the last couple of months.
Okay. Has a new building gone up between you and the radio tower? Or, and maybe ABC Master Control would know this, have they changed from an antenna here to another antenna a few kilometres away and unfortunately you're in the shadow of a hill or a building? Have you changed anything or has a building gone up between you and the tower?
I'm not 100% sure where the tower is, but there isn't any big buildings in between, like, that have been built recently near me.
Are these some of the reasons that it would happen, Carl? Because it's a hard one to answer, I'm sure, if you don't know where the tower is.
That's right. You can ring up your local... Who would you ring in ABC? ABC Master Control would not appreciate getting a phone call.
Shaking my head.
There would be somebody who would know.
Let's start giving out some phone numbers.
Some secret phone numbers. I don't know who would... There must be an ABC person who can help people with reception problems.
But it would be about interference. It wouldn't be about the fact that the radio's on the fridge. Would that have any part to play?
Well, maybe a circuit. That's a good point. Maybe a circuit inside the stereo has died. Does the stereo, last thing, does it have little pluggy things on the back where you can plug in or join on an antenna?
Yes, and the antenna has plugged in, and I've moved it around all over the place, and that doesn't make any difference.
I'm out of my depth on this one because I've got a similar problem at my place. I'm in a shadow. The only other thing you can do is to try and plug in a lead, get a splitter and plug it in off a TV antenna lead and split the TV antenna lead. Talk to the people who do antennas and they can help you.
Hey, sorry we can't help you, Cherie. Thanks so much for the call. Okay.
Thanks for listening to the show. We
love
you.
See you later. Let's head to Darwin where Nick's on the phone. Hey, Nick.
G'day, how are you going?
Great, what's your question?
Just got a question about mobile phones. I'm not sure if you've heard this one before, but sometimes when my phone's in my pocket or somewhere near me, like if it's in my pocket, I feel like a twitch in my muscle. I think it's vibrating, but when I grab it, it's not. And also I might hear the ringtone when it's around and I'll be sure that I've heard it and I'll go up to it. I mean, is my body sort of anticipating a call or am I slightly crazy or what's going on?
Your body is in a series, is always ready for attack. And so you're ready for the fact that a killer rabbit might come around the corner and kill you, or that a scorpion, or a crocodile, or that a scorpion might be crawling over your skin. So you've got a series of, we'll call them circuits, neural circuits, that on one hand are saying, get ready for something crawling on the skin, and on the other hand saying, there's nothing there. Be switched off. Over a period, because this phenomenon happens to me. So sometimes I'll think, oh, my phone is buzzing in my pocket. I'll pull it out and sure enough it's buzzing. And then every now and then I'll feel the buzzing on my leg and I'll reach out my pocket. There's no phone there. I've got it somewhere else. It's just buzzing by itself. And I think what's happened is that I have conditioned myself so that I've changed the level of awareness of that circuit. So part of the circuitry relating to my skin, which is probably the lateral cutaneous nerve from memory, part of it is it would be switched upwards so in sensitivity so that if I'm in a noisy nightclub or I'm walking around, I can pick up the buzzing of the phone on my leg, and I've accidentally wired my brain into a higher degree of sensitivity for that nerve on the side of my leg. And sometimes it just goes off by itself because the sensitivity has been set too high and it just goes off when it shouldn't. That's the best I can come up with.
Is this like a modern thing? Because, you know, obviously no phone 20 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Like if you tried saying to somebody 20 years ago, I've lost my phone, they'll say, let me have a look. Oh, it's there screwed to the wall where it's been for the last 40 years. How could you possibly lose it? And we've got a whole bunch of diseases. For example, when the people started bringing in supermarkets, the laser scanner checkout, we had checkout chick thumb, as it was called, and checkout chick wrist, where people would be grabbing the items of food and the checkout people and then twisting their wrists around and getting RSI, repetitive strain injury. So with every new invention, there's a whole bunch of diseases, and there's been, what is it, telephone thumb has come in as well.
Good on you. Thanks for the info. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Nick. Let's head to Hobart where Natalie's on the phone. Hey, Natalie.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How cold is it in Hobart today?
Pretty cold today, actually, yeah.
Are we talking below 5 degrees?
Yeah, we're talking all my windows were pretty, had condensation on them this morning.
Oh, hang on. Look, I've got a question for you, Natalie. Do you have double glazing?
Not yet. I'm in the process of getting it installed.
Right. Oh, good.
We've got it and we're in Sydney, which is really quite warm. We're not far from the ocean, so the temperature is very mild. Double glazing reduced our heating bills last year from 600 to 200. If you're inland, and in California, the government, which realised that as a government its job was to govern, said let's make double glazing compulsory. And therefore, in California, double glazing is now cheaper than single glazing because of the economies of scale. They're just making so much of it. And guess what? Everybody pays less for their heating and cooling bills.
Seems like an efficient way to do things.
How can you possibly not have the government of Australia, in various parts of Australia, make it compulsory? Getting back to your question.
What's your question, Natalie?
My question was that in complete silence, can your brain fabricate background noise? Like before bedtime, as I'm laying in bed, sometimes I swear I can hear a radio just out of comprehension or somebody speaking or
right.
a TV.
Okay, I'm going to give you a fancy word. You ready for it?
Okay.
Pareidolia.
Very fancy.
P-A-R-I-E-D-O-L-I-A. And it refers to the brain's tendency in dealing with this incredibly complicated universe around us to find patterns and make it simple. And so most of you, when you see somebody coming down the road towards you, you say, ah, that weird bunch of shapes that's changing inside, that's a human being. Whereas I say, that's a human being. Oh, God, I've got no idea who they are. Right? And so you will find the face of Jesus, because we do have photographs of him from back then, in a packet of chips or on a potato or in a cloud. And in the background noise, if there's nothing there, your brain will say, I've got to find something, and it will make up something for you.
That's awesome.
On the other hand, when you are listening to the quietest noise you can possibly listen to, your eardrum is moving backwards and forwards, a distance equal to the diameter of a hydrogen atom. And your brain is actually, when your ears are in good nick when you're young and you haven't damaged your hearing, your ears slash brain combination are almost sensitive enough, but not quite, to hear air molecules hitting your eardrum.
Oh, my gosh.
That's how good it is.
Oh, my gosh.
So it actually works on quantum effects, and so do the eye as well. So the answer is you're almost certainly making it up, but that's normal.
You're not imagining it. Good one, Natalie. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
See you later.
Thank you for that.
Getting some shout-outs on the text line as well, saying it's 14 degrees and sunny in Hobart right now. That chick from Tassie doesn't know what she's talking about.
But overnight, it probably went down to 5 or something.
I do love a bit of weather talk. Let's go to Glenelg East, where Andrew is on the phone. Hey, Andrew.
G'day, doctors. How are you going?
Very well, thanks. What's your question?
We've had some pretty cold mornings in Adelaide for the last week as well. It's, you know, when you're breathing and the fog comes out your mouth in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
We got diesel utes at work, and when they're running to warm them up, if I get a breath full of diesel fumes, I seem to blow out a lot more mist, fog out my mouth.
Hang on, say that again. If you accidentally breathe in the diesel exhaust...
Yeah, if I'm just walking past a ute and I get a breath of the diesel exhaust fumes, when I breathe out, the fog coming out of my mouth seems to increase a lot compared to when I was just having normal, just air.
Wow. Okay, and just to translate that into English for our American listeners, a ute is a small utility vehicle invented in Australia in the 1930s. Okay.
Yeah, or a truck.
Or a truck. Okay, so the reason that you get mist anyway...
Yep.
is because the temperature is low. So think about a water molecule. It looks like a boomerang.
Yep.
It's electrically charged. And so on one hand, it wants to stick to another water molecule when the temperature is low or when the temperature is high. The trouble is when the temperature is high, it's vibrating and shaking, and so the small amount of attraction is overcome by the massive amount of shaking due to the high temperature. But when the temperature is low, they're not shaking around so much and they tend to stick to each other and form droplets. Well, I'm guessing that you're breathing in the diesel fumes. By the way, can you get that taste of burnt diesel-y stuff in your mouth?
Yeah, you can smell it. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Okay, so you're breathing it in and then you breathe out. And what are you breathing out is a combination of a tiny amount of unburnt diesel but microparticles.
Right.
Now, people talk about how with diesel cars, you can get the same economy as a fancy schmancy hybrid petrol car. Yes.
Yeah.
But the pollutants in terms of particles, the diesels are still a lot dirtier. And so you're breathing out these nanoparticles, microparticles. They're called PM2.5, meaning 2.5 microns across. And they act as, going to give you a fancy word, nucleation centers, which then draw water molecules to themselves.
Right.
And then they say, in the same way, if you've got a cloud and you drop tiny particles in there, it'll make rain fall. Or if you're a chippy, or for our American listeners, a carpenter, and you're sanding, very fine sanding work on a in a hot day, suddenly you'll see all these water droplets in the air. So I think it's the particles that have gone into your lungs, and then the ones that didn't stay there came out and then set off the mist.
There you go. Thanks so much for the call, Andrew.
Thanks, doctors.
See you later.
Dr. Andrew.
See ya. Let's head to Parramatta where Keith's on the phone. Hey, Keith.
Good morning.
Good morning. Keith. What's your question?
The Rosetta satellite is catching up to a Comet 67-P, and I was just wondering what will it find when it gets there?
Okay. So about 10 years ago, we sent off this spacecraft called Rosetta, and it went looking for an asteroid called Comet 67-P, or CG for some fancy Middle European names, and this will be... Last night, something amazing happened, and for the first time, we humans put a satellite in orbit around an asteroid or comet. That's the first time it's ever happened, and we did it last night. Aren't we humans wonderful? And we're now going to get in close and try and land on it, and then take samples from it, because this, we think, is a primeval stuff of which the solar system was made. This will give us knowledge of way back then. What use will it be tomorrow? Very little. Your great-grandchildren will probably benefit a lot. We don't know what use science will be for us. So watch this space, and over the next 6 months, it's going to try and fire a harpoon, pull itself down, lock onto the surface and stay there. And that's one astronomical thing. And the other astronomical thing you're getting for free over the next couple of months, 6 months, is that later this year, a comet will go into will zip past the planet Mars, zip past at the speed of 200,000 kilometers per hour, spray all of our dozen or so satellites that we've got in orbit around Mars with little bits of sand moving at 200,000 kilometers per hour,
whoa,
and then take off again. And we're going to be looking at that as well for another astronomical phenomenon. And by the way, the guy who discovered this comet that's going to Mars, it's called Siding Spring, Rob McNaught, was a guy who discovered and gave me Planet Carl, which is 18412. Look it up on Wikipedia, my own planet, 18412.
This is like a spiral of answers coming from one question.
So to finish off, go to the ABC homepage and look up Star Stuff by Stuart Gary. He has got so much stuff about this comet.
Hey, thanks for the call, Keith.
Thank you, Keith.
And Stuart, good on you for getting three answers for the price of one. That landing on the comet thing recalls a classic American cinema experience called Armageddon. It's actually going to happen.
Yeah, it's going to happen this time. And we're going to, that is to say, our rockets will get there.
Hope Bruce Willis is on board. Let's go to Canterbury where Stuart is on the phone. Hey, Stuart.
G'day, how are you, doctors?
Very well. Stuart, welcome. What's your question?
Bit of an odd one. You're always asking for things that you haven't heard before.
Yeah.
So I was wondering what would happen if a baby was born and an umbilical cord was still connected, and hypothetically it can't breathe through its orifices. Would it still be able to survive getting oxygen through the umbilical cord?
I've forgotten so much stuff, but from memory, it's the first breath of the baby from the air that then starts the pathway that switches off the placenta and the umbilical cord. So I'm thinking from my knowledge that if you got the baby and then shove the baby into the sort of liquid that it lives in, which is basically its own urine.
Yeah.
Yes, guys, you spent the first 9 months of your life swimming in your own urine and drinking it into your lungs and breathing it out again. I think that if you kept the temperature right, it would keep on living off the umbilical cord. If there's an ONG, obstetrician and gynecology person, can you tell me if I'm right?
Even if the lungs had opened up for the first time and then got refilled, it would still survive.
I think the moment that the baby has its first breath, that kicks in the pathway that will then make the umbilical cord close down by itself.
Right, so that basically is a no.
unless the baby came out and didn't breathe and was still running off the umbilical cord. But is there another trigger? Because when the baby comes out, they normally want the baby to breathe straight away. But what if... I don't know enough about it.
We'll see if we can get an OBGYN to give us a call and flesh out that answer for you. Thanks so much for the call, Stuart.
Thank
you, Dr. Stuart.
Hey, this coming week, Dr. Carl is putting on a free event. If you're lucky to be in Sydney on Wednesday night, he's going to be doing something as a part of, is it National Science Week?
National Science Week, which runs for 2 weeks, yes.
Yes. so scientifically correct. Tell us a little bit about what it is and how people can get along, Dr.
Carl. Go to the Dr. Carl homepage, drkarl.com, and then it'll tell you all about where it is, and then it'll say, go and get some tickets, and then you try and get the tickets. It says, it's full up. Look, people don't turn up because it's free, and there's always empty seats, so just turn up at the Sydney Town Hall at 7 o'clock next Wednesday night. And if it's really, really, really full, which it never is, you can always go and have a nice cheap meal in Chinatown or something like that. I mean, it's a free gig. It's not like you're getting turned away from having paid loss. And we guarantee, Adam Spencer and I will give you a written guarantee that you will get your $0 worth of entertainment within the first 5 minutes. We guarantee that.
Oh, my gosh. You should be on Late Night TV Shopping Network. It's
the
free,
Abdominizer.
Though.
You need it.
Jahan's calling in from Melbourne. Hi, Jahan.
Doctors.
Dr. Jahan, welcome.
Jahan.
Yeah, thank you.
What's your question?
Yeah, I just want to know, is it true that reptilian muscle is 10 times stronger than mammalian muscle, and, like, why that's so?
From my reading, no. But in general, any muscle is stronger than human muscle. Okay, so we'll do it in two parts. First part, all of the primates, like the chimpanzees and the gorillas, even a little one that you can cuddle, the size of a five-year-old kid, it can rip your arms off, literally.
All right.
They're really strong. But that's because they got the genetic thing, and they always hang off trees and branches, and they're always using their upper body anyway. They don't use their lower body. Okay. Let's pick the situation where you've got a chimpanzee which has the same mass or diameter of arm muscle than you, you have. Okay. It's one for one. You measure it and the circumference is the same, right? It's still
pretty big arms.
But you pick a baby one that's not that strong. So it's got the same diameter of biceps, triceps, looking at the upper arm, as you have. Same size, and it's still stronger. And we've gone in and we've looked out and we've found why. What we have done via evolution is we have deliberately gone down a pathway where we give up strength. Our arm muscles are weaker than they should be because of neural control by the brain. But the advantage is that you can pick up a pin, or you can run your finger across something and feel little bumps in it. Whereas the primates, the chimpanzees, they can't do that. There is one circumstance when you can do that, and that's when you scratch yourself on a nail and get tetanus. And then all of your muscles go switched on to their maximum, and is no longer under the control of your nervous system. And under those circumstances, before you die of paralysis, cause all your muscles, the ones that both expand your lungs and shrink your lungs, they're both switched on, before you die, your arm muscles can either tear themselves loose from the bone or break the bone. So the answer to that question is our muscles, human muscles, are deliberately throttled back, but we get sensitivity. So you can put your hand exactly there, which the other animals can't. They're not as accurate in their placement as we are.
That's a great question. Thanks for the call, Jahan.
Thank you very much.
See you later. Let's go to Bendigo now, where Susan is on the line. Hi, Susan.
Yeah, good day. How are you going?
Very well. What's going on with you?
I had an experience a few years ago where I actually had a cardiac arrest, and they had to revive me.
But a young person like you?
Yeah.
How come?
I was bitten by a redback spider.
Oh, really? Man.
What, so it set off a reaction and your blood pressure dropped through the floor?
No. They actually gave me anti-venom.
Yeah.
And to do that, they told me they had to give me Finergan and adrenaline. And apparently they gave me too much adrenaline, which stopped my heart.
Oh, my gosh.
Because a little bit of adrenaline will get you going in too much. Wow. Go on.
Yeah. So anyway, I'll just give you a bit more of the story. When I was out of it, I actually had a dream that I was driving along with a guy and we ran off the road and hit a tree.
Mm.
And as I impacted the tree in my dream is when I woke up. And when I woke up, I thought I was in the hospital because I'd just been in a car accident. But my question is, I didn't know that I had flatlined or had, you know, was dead until after I woke up again. Mm. So do you know if you're dying or not?
You don't, almost certainly. And this is the field called NDE, near-death experience.
Yeah.
And it turns out that the retina is a very oxygen-hungry organ, and as you go down the pathway to dying, your brain is preserved. So you lose the blood supply to your muscles and your gut straight away. And you try and keep the brain going, and the retina is part of that. And then as the blood supply shrinks down, it's the central part of the retina that goes last. And if you do the physiology and the computer simulations, almost certainly you will see your vision closing down into a tunnel. Then other people add on, for whatever their training is, their social training, they add on the friendly guy with the big beard at the other end who says, "Hi, I'm Jesus, it's not your time, go back." Or it could be the religious deity of your choice. That's all added in. We don't understand the dreams and the noise that happens as you shut down. There's an article in The New Scientist about this very topic about a month ago. Look it up there. So basically, do you know you're dying? Probably not, but maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm so glad you came back. That's such an amazing story, Dr.
Yeah,
Susan.
So have I. It's a very happy ending.
Yes,
thanks so much for the call, Susan.
No worries.
That is intense. All right, let's go to Penny in Newcastle. Good morning, Penny.
Hi, Zan. Hi, Dr. Carl. How are you?
Very good, Dr. Penny.
She forgot your name.
I didn't forget yours. You're better than me.
What's your question, Dr. Penny?
Look, I can't listen to the radio at night because when I go to bed, the songs are constantly going around in my head. And last night, about 4 a.m, I woke up and there was a song that I hadn't heard for probably about a week. So how is it that songs get trapped in your brain like that?
This is the bit where I failed. Daniel Levitin has written, how do you spell Levitin?
L-E-V-I-T-I-N.
Okay. He was a guy who started off in various fields of psychology, dropped out, became a roadie, radio producer, and then went back into the psychology side. And he's written an article on this about the music worm, or what's the other term for it?
Earworm. Yep.
And
he wrote a whole book, This Is Your Brain on Music.
Yeah. And he answers it, and I read it, and I've forgotten the answer. It got pushed out by the comet. So as I've only got a very small RAM, and as new information comes in, old information gets pushed out, and I've forgotten the answer.
Look, it's worth Googling him. He's definitely – we actually had him on. I don't know if the podcast still exists, but we had him on joining us from the States, I believe, doing some talk back. But if you just Google Daniel Levitin
– And
this
earworm.
Is an earworm, or This Is Your Brain on Music, you might be able to find some information about it because it does exist.
It's real.
And this is kind of the cornerstone of pop music, isn't it? If you write a great hook, it gets stuck in your head.
I remember walking around the kids' hospital in my first year as a doctor there singing – I should be so lucky, lucky, from Kylie Minogue.
Thank you for putting that in our head, Dr. Carl.
Thanks so much, Penny.
Bye.
Let's head to Brizzy, where Darren is on the phone. Hey, Darren.
Hey, how's it going, doctors?
Great.
Hey,
what's
Darren.
Your question?
Is there any visible signs of disturbed air or dirty air around eagles while they're soaring in thermals, or is it just an illusion? Or
what have you seen? Tell me.
Well, we're watching an eagle soar, and the wife sort of asked, how do they stay up there? And I tried to explain to her the science behind thermals and updraft and that. And she goes, I think I can see it. And I just thought, okay, I don't know what she can see. And then after watching for a while, I could sort of see like a grey, shadowy sort of area. And I thought, maybe it's an illusion. Like when you look at something dark and then look at something light, you can see the like it just stays there sort of thing, or it blurs sort of thing. I thought it might have been that, but it actually appeared to be like wisping, like curling up as it sort of went through, like it was, and I've tried to Google it and can't really find anything about it.
And where can you see this discoloration? Was it around the boundaries of the body of the eagle?
It was sort of at the tips, like the most noticeable bit was at the tips where the long sort of feathers sort of spread right out. And, it seemed to be curling up. Like it was, as if there was sort of like dye in the air and you're watching like a wind tunnel sort of thing.
Right. Now, okay, imagine that you've got a sheet of paper.
Yep.
And imagine that you can balance it. So you're lying on the ground on your back and you're blowing upwards from your mouth. You've got infinite air and you're blowing upwards and you can keep that sheet of paper in the air as long as you've got breath to blow on it. The air is going past the sheet of paper. It hits the bottom of the paper and holds it up and then keeps on going and flows around the edges. So at all times, there is a current of air going past the sheet of paper. In the same way, the eagle has found this updraft of warm air and it's barely moving its feathers at all, only if it does, just to keep itself in the middle of that spiral of warm air. But the air is going past. There is a blast of air going past the tips of the feathers. Now, if you go to Wikipedia and look up S-C-H-L-E-R-E-I-N photography, and this is a modality where you can actually see the otherwise invisible air, and maybe something had set itself up that you could actually see these shlurring thingies. And I'm insanely jealous that you saw it, because, and also your powers of observation and your wife are just gorgeous.
Yeah, yeah, like we'd watched them for like a, you know, like over a period of time, like when you see them randomly, and like I didn't know, she couldn't explain what she could see. Like I just thought maybe she, you know, like yeah, could see like the pocket, but then once I saw it, it was like yeah, just yeah, it was hard to explain. But
do you know how to spell that word, Dr. Carlson?
No, it doesn't like S-C-H-L-E-R-I-E-N. So if somebody knows it out there, just Twitter it and we'll read it out over on the air.
All right, we'll see if we can help you out with the correct spelling of it. Thanks so much for the call, Darren.
No, thank you.
Also, a few people helping us out on the text line. Schlierian photography.
How do you spell that?
Okay, so this is how you spell it. This okay. is what Dr. Carl was talking about just before the song. S-C-H.
L-I-E-R-E-N.
Schlierian photography.
Right.
And another great text regarding near-death experiences. Someone said, I died several times in ICU after a motorbike accident. I didn't see any man with a beard, also known as Jesus, though my dreams did start to go dark and I had a need to breathe. One dream I was in a boat on a river and my hat blew off. I was swimming down to get it. It was becoming dark and I needed to breathe, so I returned to the surface. Opening my eyes, I was in the ICU and I saw doctors and nurses around my bed.
Aww.
So there you go. Hopefully it's not an experience that many people have been in, but I'm glad that the people who have lived to tell the tale. It is a really bizarre place to be in, isn't it, the near-death experience? And it's, as you say, a very unknown scientific place as well as to what happens. We are talking science with Dr. Carl this morning. Still time for some of your calls, and we're going to head now to Chris, who's calling in from Dubbo. Hey, Chris.
Hi, guys. How are you going?
Great. What's your question?
My question is about lightning striking a car. I know the thing that protects you is Faraday's cage, but I'm not sure how that's a current in the metal around you, but I'm not sure how it works when lightning's striking the car.
Not sure if I know what you mean as far as I understand it. And let me point out, I have forgotten so much of my electromagnetism. But basically, the electrical spike, which is of the order of millions of volts, cannot penetrate into the cage that is the metal of the car. So you've got a metal floor, metal roof, and metal sides. And there are little holes or big holes in the windows where it can come through. I do not know the physics of how a Faraday cage works, apart from the fact that it does. I have actually, in America, because these tap-and-go cards are becoming so common in Australia, I've bought myself a portable Faraday cage for my wallet. It's a fine stainless...
Oh, you mean like a PayWave card?
Yeah, the PayWave cards. Because apparently the PayWave cards are not encrypted. And so you just get your PayWave card and you come up to a taggy thing and it's like cash and you just bounce it near it and it gets within a few centimetres and it reads it and it says, okay, we'll take $4 off you and you don't have to sign anything. It's just like cash. And a few years ago at a Black Hat conference in Las Vegas, somebody walked through a crowd with what looked like a camera around their neck, but it was not. And they read all the RFIDs on passports and PayWave cards within a metre and a half of them. They are not encrypted, according to the cops. I read this in the Herald. And so mine is protected with a stainless steel mesh. So getting back to the, which is a Faraday cage. I don't know the physics of how a Faraday cage works, sorry.
But it does work.
It does work.
So it's just surrounded by that metal cage and the frequency cannot penetrate it. That's what
well,
the process is.
Read Wikipedia. Frequency is not the right word. I don't know what the right word is either.
Yeah, sorry, we don't have an answer for you today.
I failed.
All right. Thanks so much, Chris.
You're okay. I'm the one who failed.
We've got time for one more quick one, and it's relating to something we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. Hello, Adam in Bunbury.
How you going?
Great. What's your question?
The other week, I think it was, you were talking about, I think it was a lady rang up wanting to know why you see flash of lights if you get hit in the head. Excuse me. And it was, I can't remember the name, triretinol something, I think, was the name of the chemical. And basically what Dr. Carl explained was under slight pressure or a slight light, the chemical gave off an electric charge.
Yep.
Now, I'm wondering, basically, if you can...
Really quickly, Adam, we've got to go. What's your question? What's your question?
Can you produce the chemical, and if you can you harness that electric charge?
Yes and yes. The chemical is called 11-cis-cis, retinal, R-E-T-I-N-A-L, and when it's hit by a photon of light or mechanical pressure, it will change shape into 11-trans, T-R-A-N-S, retinal, and at the same time give off electricity, and you have millions and billions of these chemicals in each rod or cone, and they're all summed together to give you this full wraparound sensation we call vision, and yes, you can make it.
Thanks so much for the call, Adam.
No worries, thank you.
That's all the time we have this morning, but Dr. Carl will be back with us next week, and don't forget, we also have some huge guests live in studio with you, Adam and Jamie from Mythbusters, joining us for the full hour of Science Talkback next week from 11 a.m. They're going to be here in the country touring around doing shows, but before they begin them, they are all yours for 1 hour of Science Talkback with Dr. Carl. We'll see you then.